Oh, you're here for the first time. This is a summary of the practice of Lojong. So maybe we'll start at the end and then you can recover the beginning. And this has been an odd presentation insofar as most times the Lojong material has been presented in the order in which the points go. However, we've hopped around a bit, which means that I have the middle. There are 7 points. I'm number 4. So there are 3 on one side, 3 on the other. So this is going to be a summary and continuation. The other thing that has made it a little weird is that, we've been sort of taking shots at it here and there over the course of several months. And so it's easy to lose the continuity. So what I'd like to do is remind us of the continuity, which also will serve to introduce the continuity if you haven't heard it before. The word Lojong means to train the mind. And this form of Buddhism is very much about taking the mind that you already have and all of its magnificence and transforming it into something more useful to you and others than perhaps it is presently. So Lojong is a means by which you go through your life, sometimes on the cushion, sometimes doing your daily life, and you blend your life you blend the situations with your life with various teachings that are implied here. And the result is that you first become a gentler, more intelligent person, and eventually you become enlightened. That may take a few lifetimes, but it's you're on the right track. So we begin. There are 7 points, if you recall. First point, train in the preliminaries. And the preliminaries are basically an acknowledgement of reality, that we experience profound dissatisfaction, that we are trying very hard to ward off death, and we're all going to fail. Okay, all of us, without exception, no matter how hard we try or don't try, we all wind up dead. We also appreciate that, unlike a lot of people, we have opportunities. We are here, and we're able to reflect. We're able to look at ourselves. We're able to think about how to best be of use. A lot of people, pure survival. So these are preliminaries, which begins the main practice, which is twofold bodhicitta. And Trawag Rinpoche in the book talks about generating relative bodhicitta and realizing absolute bodhicitta. Now, bodhicitta, if you recall, is that soft heart, that compassionate attitude, that desire to connect with others and help them suffer less and be happier in this life and elsewhere. Absolute bodhicitta prevents us from becoming radical missionaries. Is acknowledgement that reality is far more fluid, far more non-conceptual than we thought. And so we want to realize that state of mind that appreciates the insubstantiality of our world, which actually gives us tremendous ability to be flexible, to do different kinds of things, because nothing's solid. So the main practice is training the twofold bodhicitta, relative and absolute. Then, of course, we have to take it on the road a little bit. And this is different, as we've said, from like abundance Christianity, where it's, you know, you have faith and things will work out for you because God will take care of you. Here, this is Buddhism. We expect you to encounter problems. Really, really quickly and unendingly. And so...
Don't go into sales.
I never go into sales.
Okay.
I promise. Okay. But, however, we also know that these are the condition of our lives, and we have to... we can use these as opportunities to move beyond our habitual patterns, move beyond ego, to appreciate that we're all in the same soup, that there's tremendous vitality there. And so we have slogans like, drive all blames into one self, not one's spouse. I know. Some of us are much better with that practice than the slogan. Then there's be grateful to everyone. How to look at the nature of mind to protect us from solidifying reality. Now, so those are the first three points. On the other side are more practical things. There are guidelines. There's like how to evaluate our practice. You are well trained if you can practice even when distracted. All of us have found out how well we can practice when we're distracted. As well as of the two judges, rely on the principal one. In other words, everyone thinks you're doing really well and they really like you, and you know better. You know you have a long way to go. Then there are guidelines of mind training, which is how to look at specific situations. Don't bring things to a painful point. Or don't go into politics. Don't transfer the ox's load to the cow. In other words, don't expect someone to do something that you can't do yourself. And then there's a seventh point, which is one of my favorites. Whichever of the two occurs, be patient. The two things are things that we know we have to be patient with, like adversity, the things we don't want to be patient with, like good news. So like it tells us to have more greater equanimity. So these are guidelines. They help us through specific situations. Mm-hmm. What's in the middle, point four, somewhat the ugly duckling of the seven points of the teaching. That's why Emily asked me to do it. Because nobody else would want to.
That's right. Give Joseph the hardest.
Inspired.
Yes. She's transferring the ox of love to God. And the reason is they are very general. There's something that you have to do, something that you have to create meaning from yourself. They're not telling you what to do, what not to do. And they have to do with life, how to handle the rest of our lives, as well as how to handle our death. And so here we have the opportunity to talk about dying. Since it's going to happen anyway, we may as well sort of get used to the idea. And so there are two slogans, one about life, one about death. Each contain five what they call powers or forces. And interesting, the idea of or strengths, sometimes they're called strengths. They are abilities that we all have already, which is, I think, why we look at this as seems a little boring. It's like, I know this. But we all can do these five things. However, we could be better at them. We could be stronger. We could also channel them into productive directions instead of what we often do, which is channel them into unproductive directions. What I've given you is from Jungian Kontrol's great Path of Awakening, which is a very pithy presentation, because there are different ways that these words are rendered. There are different ways that the teachers look at these. So I want to give you some different angles, we'll call it. And however, for the most part, we're going to look at Trawog Rinpoche's book, and he has the most elaborate presentation. He's really into these.
Yeah.
I remember reading this a few months ago for the first time in a long time, saying, wow, this is really good. If nothing else, you are encouraged to come back to this chapter and reread it, that would be great, because he was, unfortunately, very wise and he's very gentle. But different teachers have different presentations. So, there are five forces or powers. Now, I like the idea of forces because there's a sort of a Star Wars connection, I think. You know, which side of the force are you on? And there are sort of five categories, you could call it. And these are all things that we all do. So, the first slogan, train in the five forces. Notice it says train. So these are processes. And as we know, when our training, we two steps forward, one step back, we lose focus for a while, we recover focus. The point about all of these, especially these first five, is there's a continuity. These are some things that we can do like anytime. And we can do that for the rest of our lives very productively. So the first one, Jungian Kontrol calls impetus. And Trawog Rinpoche calls aspiration. And Trungpa Rinpoche calls strong determination. And each rendering has a certain attitude. Impetus implies movement. You're propelling yourself. And what are you propelling yourself toward? You are beginning to orient yourself in a certain direction toward developing the twofold bodhicitta. And they often talk about, what's the first thing you're thinking in the morning? How do you sort of map out your day in terms of your attitude? Most of us, well, I suspect most of us, I know me, it's like, okay, I gotta do this, I gotta do that. How much time do I have for this? Can I squeeze that in? Da, da, da. I mean, that's normal discursiveness. We all do that. But what's the attitude we're taking? Is it, oh, God? Or does it have some kind of an uplifting quality? Our inspiration, our impetus toward the day could be to develop that kind of compassionate mind of relative bodhicitta, to see reality as well as we can during the day. That can underline all the other stuff that we do to sort of get started. It's interesting, many of you have been to talks by Tibetan teachers, to Westerners. often they begin by saying, all right, people, take a moment. Think about that you are not here listening to the Dharma just for yourselves, that this is to benefit all beings. Consider all beings in your thoughts right now. Think about how you would like to benefit them. And everyone sits silently for a few moments, and then the talk proceeds. And that's how they start the talk. And it's not a bad way how to start the day. It's hard to pull off. Please, Megan.
I was listening to a talk by my teacher, Khandra Rinpoche, today. And she was talking about Patro Rinpoche and how people would come from wide and far to listen to him. And he would have them all gather, and he would tell them, in order to attend my teachings, the very first thought in your mind when you wake up must be, may my mind be kind. And so he would send them all away to go sleep. And then early in the morning, he would have a monk come out and sound a loud gong. And when they woke up in the morning, he would ask them, what was the first thought in your mind?
What the hell is that
woken
noise?
By this loud gong. And if it wasn't, may my mind be kind, then do not come to my teachings. And then, when you did manage to think that, and you all gathered for the teachings, he purposely had the monks leave the door very tightly closed so that you had to squeeze in one at a time. And if upon entering the hall, if you could not maintain, may my mind be kind, you should step away and go and come back.
Very good.
And that was his mentality, is that if you could not come in with that mantra, may my mind be kind, you will not be able to receive the teachings.
So this needn't be heavy-handed. It can be. People can get really pious and a little too religious for my own taste doing this sort of thing. But we can all check in what our attitude is. Not just waking up, but any activity that we do that may have a positive result. And then at the end of the day, well, how did I do? I don't know about you, but I get into bed, it's like, oh, I'm done.
Made it through another day.
Got it through another day. I could be a little more reflective. But so this sense of impetus can propel us through the day, and it's not that. Oh, it's a training. The more we do it, the more we attend to it, the more we appreciate its value, the more we'll want to do it, the more it will begin to happen. Which brings us to the second. Oh, by the way, here's what Jamin Khandro says about the first. Oh, Jamin Khandro lived in the 1800s and was a very famous Tibetan teacher of both the Kagyu and Nyingma lineages. Okay. From the moment, I love how he says this. From the moment until enlightenment, or at least now until I die, especially for the next year and the next month, and definitely from today until tomorrow, the two aspects of bodhicitta will never be absent from my mind. So it's kind of a one day at a time proposition, but do it a day at a time. Which brings us to familiarization. Sometimes called habituation. Just like we have the power to aspire, to put an image in our mind of what we want, we also have the power to create and break habits. We are habitual creatures. Does anyone have a disagreement about that? We need habits. I wouldn't be able to get here from, you know, Rhode Island without having done it a few times and knowing what I'm doing and It was not stressful because I developed the habit. I knew exactly what I was doing. I didn't have to think about it. That's what habits are. And we all know that habits can be... bad habits can be very solid, can be very stubborn. It's hard to break bad habits. How do we break bad habits when we do? We may not have much experience with that.
You have to be very concentrated and alert.
Alert. That will break a habit for about a day and a half. Mm-hmm. Then we're exhausted.
Well,
yes.
Maybe. Okay. I differ a little bit.
How so?
Well, if the habit is occurring moment to moment, then all you are is alert. I mean, you have to be aware. You employ
How
awareness.
How about one's habit of having a cheese Danish every day?
Oh, that's good. Which I was thinking, you were saying.
I mean, let's start with the trivial.
Okay, because when you were saying habit, I was thinking more like patterns of mind.
Oh, you know? That's a bit. Okay, I understand. We're Buddhists, yes, yeah, sure. Yeah. Understood. I'm talking very
talking
mundane. I'm talking very mundane stuff.
Actually, it's quitting cigarettes.
Quitting cigarettes. The habit of blaming your spouse for everything that goes wrong.
I think both are the same, though.
Yeah.
The habit of the mind and habit of having a cigarette or habit of having a Danish are the same thing.
Is
your desire to change the habit greater than the strength of the habit?
Mm.
And then what perpetuates that desire?
What perpetuates that desire and what maintains that desire?
Mm-hmm.
That's hard because desire, we have our moments of weakness. Desires waver.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is we have to be direct but very patient. We have to accept the fact that sometimes we screw up. That, you know, we start with
often,
a certain kind of...
Often we screw up. Sorry,
I try to be generous with this. That we have to know how to be kind to ourselves and how to be cutting. Hard to do. So we do this over time. We have to often, we break a bad habit by a better habit. I don't want to go so far as to say a good habit, because a better habit. So, you're not smoking, but you're eating. It's a better habit. Later, you'll be, drinking smoothies compulsively. A better habit than that. But with the good habits, the same mechanism, it has to develop over time. And I was thinking of... Anyone here expert in Aristotle? Because sometimes people are.
Which part of Aristotle's?
What's that?
What part of Aristotle?
Nicomachean Ethics, Book 2.
No.
Damn.
Precise there.
Simply because...
It is a trick question.
Aristotle talks about how we become virtuous.
Okay.
He says... You know the phrase second nature? It comes from Book 2 of the Nicomachean Ethics. He says, we have potential. We have potential to be courageous. We have potential to be kind. But we have to develop that potential into something that's stable. A stable virtue, you would say. How do we do it? We do it through practice. We do it through making something. He called it second nature. That's familiarization. So if it's difficult for you to generate that aspiration to be kind first thing in the morning, you develop it over time by repeated practice until it becomes a labored kind of activity, but consistent. Then it becomes automatic. We have actually sown the seeds of a positive habitual pattern. And that's what we do with twofold bodhicitta. How often do we forget that we want to benefit beings? All the damn time. Yet we practice at it over and over. And until it sort of becomes, gradually soaks into us.
I'd add to that that not waiting until your mind is there before you do it.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know...
If you wait for your mind, you're going to be waiting a very long time.
A lot of people think, I want to help, but I don't feel like I'm ready. You know, my mind isn't there, but it's like, get out there and help. And then later on, the mind will catch up.
Exactly.
But it's better to do the kind action and not be right there with your mind than to wait until your mind is prepared to do the kind action.
Yeah. And we'll surprise ourselves by what we can do when we give ourselves a chance. Often fear gets in the way. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Any other thoughts about familiarization?
I think about drug addiction because I've worked with homeless people, and that it's hard to say. Well, the strength should be stronger than the the habit or something. It's very confusing. And what I see in them and myself is the motivation changing.
Yes.
I mean, the motivation's there one day and then forget it.
Right.
A week.
And so, if you can find an incompatible habit and just practice that over and over. Please.
Just a thought. It almost seems like you're shifting familiarity from the bad habit to the better habit, where it's like, this is, what I'm comfortable with now, this is, something that I don't like or it's not good for me, but it's, familiar, but I have to really work hard to sort of, move in the other direction to where now, this is familiar to me, this is comfortable, and that is distant, not so familiar anymore, and I don't feel that,
It loses its tug on us.
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember someone telling me it's easier to do something than to not do something.
Mm-hmm.
Say,
in
I'm
fact,
not going to do it. That's like,
in fact, one cannot not act. We're always doing something, right? So we take advantage of that. We do something else. Yeah. And obviously recovery from addiction is replete with possibilities for people to do something else instead.
Yeah, it's a great deal, and I think it's diversion to do something
right.
else.
Right, yes, absolutely. And then there's planting virtuous seeds. This is a particular favorite of mine. Because it gets so often neglected and so important. And Trolloc Rinpoche, who wrote a separate book on karma, by the way, which I would recommend reading if you haven't, his discussion of this this point uses the idea of karma a lot. And here the idea is we have so-called white seeds, black seeds. And their seeds are like mustard seeds. They're teeny, teeny, teeny. But they grow into something large. And what they grow into, we will reap the result of. And so, here, and there's going to be some overlap with familiarization. What we do is we notice the little things. The little acts of kindness. The things that we don't think of as very important. We all want to be heroic. We all want to do grand gestures, but that's not where most of life is. When I counsel people about weight loss, it's like, how do you go on a diet? Well, a diet is like 20 decisions a day. It's really easy if you're willing to make 20 decisions a day. Meaning that you have your vision, you have what you want to do, But then every day has its opportunities and its perils, and you have to do these little things that eventually form patterns of behavior. So the difference between familiarization and the sowing white seeds is that the white seeds are things that come to us that we can fertilize, perhaps. Is that clear? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
We cannot not do things.
One thing I do very consciously is when I'm driving, if somebody wants to get in the traffic line,
yes.
I make a point of letting them in. And I also make an aspiration at the same time that they will be kind and let somebody else in too.
Yeah.
So it's like, so I think I'm spreading, I'm spreading bodhicitta because it's not just me, you know, and then I, of course, pat myself on the back.
We'll get to that. Emily, that's the next one.
They cover everything in this region.
They do. They know us well.
They do.
And so, you know, think about all the, you know, there's a well-known quote that you want to fill a bucket, you can fill a bucket one drop at a time. The bucket will eventually be filled. And so that's what white seeds are, or virtuous activities can be. And nothing beats doing stuff. Thinking stuff is good, but it's much weaker than doing stuff. Then we get to Dalai Rinpoche calls it exposure. Jagmeet Kondro calls it repudiation. Trungpa Rinpoche calls it reproach. And we have this power of being able to form an image of ourselves and talk to it. Not every living creature can do that, but we do that. I can talk to myself all the time, and I, you know, Joe, you could have done that a little better, you know? Like, who am I talking to? But we do this. That's the power of reproach, repudiation, exposure. That we all know that we are really good at noticing the shortcomings of other people. We are expert, we're pros.
I'm not.
Except Emily, who is, you know, so much more saintly than the rest. We also know that when it comes to assessing ourselves soberly, we're not so good. We tend to distort things. We tend to make excuses. We give ourselves a hard time on stuff that is, like, stupid. We give ourselves a pat on the back when things that we really have to change. We're doing that sort of thing all the time. So reproach uses that ability to survey ourselves and to bring out or bring into awareness our limitations. And we all know that that can be humbling, humiliating, frightening, depressing. It can also be liberating because it's a little more difficult for us to disingenuously take somebody else's inventory when we've just taken our own. It's really hard because we realize that the stuff that we don't like about them, that we notice about them, they're simply a mirror for us. And so reproach is, or exposure is, the ability to talk tough to ourselves sometimes. And I have to read you Trungpa Rinpoche's depiction of this because it's hilarious. This is like in his working with the slogans, this is the one thing that always comes to me most vividly. This strength is based on reproaching your ego. You have courage to say to your ego, you have created tremendous trouble for me, and I don't like you. You have caused me so much trouble by making me wander in the lower realms of samsara. I have no desire at all to hang around with you. I'm going to destroy you, this you. But who are you anyway? Go away. I don't like you. You find similar things in Shanti Deva too. If you ever want to talk to yourself, Rinpoche says, you should talk in this way. In fact, sometimes talking to yourself in that way is highly recommended and very helpful. It is even worth talking to yourself in that way while taking a shower or sitting on the toilet seat. When you are driving, instead of turning on the radio, you can turn on your reproach to your ego. If you're accompanied by somebody, you might feel embarrassed, but you could still whisper to yourself. He says, that is the best way to become an eccentric bodhisattva. I hope we all take this to heart. So if I hear you talking to yourself, I know you're doing good.
I think it's really important, though, to point out this isn't like calling yourself a piece of shit. This isn't in the same family.
Not
as
at
that.
All. Thank so, you.
And I think it's really easy.
We need to do this with a sense of its limits and its scope. That this is done with an attitude of gentleness and
humor.
Humor and sort of a regard or appreciation.
Mm-hmm. Humor.
Humor. Because myself, I recognize myself that I push back against harsh criticism. And I get defensive with it. So, and I just shut it out.
Mm-hmm.
Humor, though, opens me up like nothing else.
Sure.
And hence Khandra Rinpoche being my
sure,
teacher.
Sure.
I find that when I am in the shower.
She's gotten very funny over the years.
Yes, I know.
She used to be less funny
even in her older talks.
It's really hard.
So in the shower, which I do the self talk thing. For me the reflection is more like just a kind of laughing at myself.
Yes.
Like, wow, that thought just came right up. And to me, addressing it with humor has me see just how ridiculous it is.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a kinder approach that kind of puts it into a sense of light in some sense, but also like a shot of reality.
Well, sort of like you would talk to one of your kids
yes.
when they screwed up. It's
yes.
like you still love them.
Yes.
You want the best for them, but you know, you got to do that a little yeah. better, okay?
Yeah. Is I would say to my teens, you're being the perfect teenager. Yeah.
My father had more choice words, but okay.
And you're still going to clean your room.
You're a perfect teenager who's going to clean your room.
That's
yes.
it.
So I think we know what reproach is. And it's not... The last thing we want to do is beat ourselves, is to bludgeon ourselves for being human. But we do want to be objective. And we want to have a good, loving sense of our potential and desire to live up to that. Which brings us to what's called aspiration, or maybe a better word is dedication. And dedication, we'll be doing some of that at the end of our time together tonight. We're going to dedicate the merit. This is what we're talking about. This is what happens at the end of doing something. At the beginning, there's aspiration to be of benefit, to do what you do, to increase compassion, increase understanding and love. At the end, well, remember, this is the law of karma, is you've done something good. You have some white seeds happening here. Great. What's going to happen with that? Usually, in terms of the law of karma, benefits accrue, but eventually they get used up. It's sort of like, you know, you put some gas in your car like I did, and this, you have a full tank of gas, and at some point you see the needle lowering itself. It's like, oh, I got to get more gas. Well, a lot of the virtuous activity we do is kind of like that. I got to do it again because it just ran out. However, if we dedicate the merit, everybody says we multiply the benefit. We spread it out. And so one should dedicate the merit as a joyfully, because you have, because it's the opposite of self-congratulation. It's the opposite of, you know, collecting brownie points for yourself, which, you know, we all do. We're so good at knowing how often we've been kind, but not so well noticing how other people have been kind. So we could do better. So we dedicate, we sort of give it away. And that's that kind of dedication or aspiration. And so also any adverse circumstances, any things we do that are difficult, we take them as opportunities to develop bodhicitta, develop that awakened heart further. So these five things, these five strengths, forces, allow us to live our lives genuinely and compassionately, and especially to grow. If you read many books by famous Buddhists like the Dalai Lama, they say, you know, I'm not quite there with this bodhicitta thing, but I'm really inspired by it, and I work hard at it. And I think that's a good model for us. You know, it's sort of progress, not perfection. And that's what these five strengths are about. We aspire to be of benefit, we become familiar, we develop good habits toward that end, we look at the small stuff, we work with our limitations, we dedicate the merit afterwards, the whole thing is sealed and complete. And then we die. And as you all know, Buddhism has all kinds of teachings about dying. And they're timely and important. And have really done a lot toward helping many of us wake up to the fact that death is real and it comes without warning. This body that we take from here to there, that people welcome, that people like, eventually is going to be a dead body that nobody wants. All this is our fate. So the teachings on dying presuppose that during death, the body dies, the mind in some form continues through an intermediate state, through successive lifetimes. In that way, these teachings are powerful because they allow us to take a very wide view of this, our life, but also allow us some kind of absolute perspective upon our upcoming death. And now this is written from obviously a traditional Tibetan point of view. And unfortunately, you know, we know that a lot of people who, you know, a lot of people die in hospitals, heavily sedated, not very conscious, and their minds seem to sort of shut off gradually. Here, they're supposing that you're struck with some kind of illness, and you know that you're going to die from that, and you have a little bit of time. And so that's sort of the scenario which this stuff is presented. But we can play around with it, too. Yes.
I mean, that's a certain circumstance, but many people die without warning.
Exactly.
So I assume they'll get to that at some point.
Well, let's get to that. Let's get to that. Trungpa Rinpoche says we should rehearse our own death. And that's something I sort of do. I'm much better at that than aspiration bodhicitta first thing in the morning, actually. Some of us will die suddenly, perhaps, and we still have a state of mind that continues. And obviously, there's a tremendous dislocation when that occurs. Yet the same principles have got to apply. We just don't have time to go through a process. We're like there. I think that's the best I can. If one of us dies suddenly, we'll tell the other, okay?
I don't know. Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. No, the idea is you're preparing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And it's something that there's a great deal of emphasis in the Tibetan traditions of Buddhism. And it's something that we can all do as just a contemplation, simply relating to the fact that we spend an enormous amount of energy keeping ourselves alive, warding off pain, freaking out when we're under some kind of threat. These are all presages of death. When, after my father died, I got into this weird habit, not a weird habit, it's a good habit, I thought, that when I felt uncomfortable, I was tired or thirsty or physically something wasn't working or I was sick. It's like, hey, this is nothing. Eventually I'm going to be dying. So what am I complaining about this for? This is sort of like rehearsal time. And that was actually very helpful. But, you know, we have our different paths, and maybe I'm a little more morbid than some others. So we have the same five strengths, but they're sometimes presented in different order because we're doing different things here. They start with planting white seeds, which is usually number three. What that means is when we know that we may die soon, we, as well as we can, drop our resentments, attachments, panic. We also stop clutching onto our stuff, our people. We become willing to let go. And we all know that letting go is like, it's not an abstract thing. So we let go of this, we let go of this, we let go. I think that's what it means, white seeds. It just happens over and over again. And so that process of saying goodbye and giving, letting go and giving up our stuff. And it talks about, you know, giving stuff to, it talks about the three jewels, but any possibility that seems most beneficial. And, you know, people do that. Then we get to aspiration. And here is the same aspiration, the same impetus. We wish to develop twofold bodhicitta. Maybe in this lifetime, I only got so far, but I want to continue this. This is worth the effort over many lifetimes. So I aspire to meet teachings, meet a teacher, meet a circumstance, meet the right conditions so that I can continue this process. Because it's the meaning of life and the meaning of many lifetimes. Repudiation or reproach, pretty easy. We are watching ourselves dissolve. We are watching our ego dissolve and becoming freaked out. We can actually give ourselves a bit of a kick in the butt. Say, okay, ego, you can go away now. I don't need you. We may not be able to sit on the toilet, but we have a bedpan. We can still reproach our ego during the dying process. It's like, this: you are causing me to stay stuck and to suffer. And that inability to let go is an activity of ego. And so I would think that during the dying process, that activity becomes more prominent, more transparent. I would think. Then there's impetus. Which is that kind of firm resolve. And finally, familiarization, which implies at the end that you are well practiced in all of this stuff. So none of this is particularly upsetting or even that important. And it talks in this point about us being close to death, what that may be like, and how we can die. And it says here, posture is important. It'll talk about being in a certain Buddha posture with your on the right side. That's a traditional posture for dying, since that's the way the Buddha died. So you're sort of imitating the Buddha. So even at your last breath, there's an aspiration to continue. So that is like hardly scratching the surface of the iceberg of the teachings on death and dying in Buddhism. But there's a lot to take home with you. That's the point of all this. Yes.
I have one question.
Sure.
You mentioned regrets. Can you just add that a bit?
Yes. Regrets go in two categories. One, the first category of aspiration, which is to attempt to let go of them. One of the activities of becoming old is the so-called life review, where one has to look at all the missed opportunities and all the screw-ups in life and come to terms with our regret. And I think that's part of the process here. On the level of reproach, though, it's like it's too late. And you need to drop the self-absorption that comes with regret. Because it's all about me. And maybe one can regret not loving enough. But that becomes aspiration to try harder as we go up, go on past death. Do you have a follow-up? Is that clear enough? Okay.
Thank you.
It's something we'll all go through. Something we can go through today. You know, people say I want to die with no regrets, and I think that's a worthy aspiration, as it were. So the point of Lojong, and this sort of ties together the whole thing, actually. The point of Lojong is, we take all these ideas and we don't talk about them much. We don't even think about them much. Instead, we let our life happen and we cross-pollinate this material with our life. Because we're all going to go home and you're going to go to sleep, hopefully, and going to wake up the next morning, and we have all kinds of challenges and possibilities and all kinds of things that confuse us or annoy us or make us, you know, dizzy with joy. And so we can work on things as they arise, but these five strengths allow us to sort of continually build as we're moving along. It's kind of like there's some symphonic pieces, and I'm sure Mr. Levin can give you about eight examples. I can only think of two right now, where it starts with like one instrument or one beat, And then slowly, you're doing the same variation with a little more elaboration, a little more instrumentation, and then more and more, until there's this huge crescendo. But it starts small, and the building is just beautiful to watch, to listen to. That's kind of what these five forces are like in our lives.
So, yes, Bolero.
Example?
Bolero.
Okay. I don't. You do?
I do. I'm sorry.
He doesn't like it.
I can't stand Bolero. It drives me nuts.
It's a piece of sarcasm, basically. Sorry.
The second movement of Scheherazade is like that. The invasion theme, Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, is like that. It's just marvelous. But not Bolero. Anything but Bolero.
That's the first thing that came to mind. I couldn't think of the name.
Okay. Now my mind's going to be like, boom.
I know, you'll hear
the entire road back to Detroit.
That's why you don't like it, because you can't get rid of it. That's the hard part.
Of course. Good. There are other reasons not to like it, but that's one of them. So, please.
More mundane in nature. You were mentioning something about the right side and how Buddha died. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that? I don't know that. Maybe it's too elaborate, I'm not sure.
The idea is to... I guess we could... We're not going to try it here, but... To get on the right side... And sort of with one hand, sort of resting your head, and you block this nostril, and that is to keep certain kinds of airflow from escaping. And I just don't know. I just don't remember the details, but. These teachings are fairly consistent that this is a very good way to die.
Is that where you want the coldness to come from, the toes to the top of the head, not the other way?
I honestly don't remember.
It's a whole series of steps of how the body shuts down, essentially.
Yeah, with the elements dissolving
into each other.
There are certain hallucinations that go along with
it. Right, and then how to approach each hallucination and each stage along the way. It's quite articulate.
There's a wonderful book by Ponyvok Rinpoche that goes through great detail the dissolving of the elements. Yeah. And it can be part... Learning that is part of contemplating one's dying.
What's the book?
Mind Beyond Death.
Thank you.
Mind Beyond Death. Ponyvok Rinpoche.
It's really quite excellent. And I would recommend that as a... Mm-hmm.
We have a copy in our Buddhist library if you want to borrow. I think we have an extra, but I'll have to check.
Sadly, it's almost 9, so I wonder if there's anyone... did I miss something? Any lingering... Lingering doubts?
Could it be said that the relation between the two of these is that the right way to live is the right way to die?
That's right. That's right. Thank you.
Makes sense, yeah.
I also want to make a comment, because I think we can't really ignore it, how we use white and black.
Right.
And it's we notice now. I think that's the good thing is we notice. White is good. White people are good. Black is bad. Black people are bad. That's obviously not what we're talking about. But this is rooted in really old teachings. And
not Tibetan teachings. They didn't have that particular racism.
No, I'm not saying it was racist.
No, not the racism.
But the color association.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But later on, things evolved over time. So it is not intended to be associated at all with white as, the white race versus the black people.
And I do notice that there's a lot more black in our attire than there is white. I don't see any white at all.
Not far, Joseph.
I see tons
of
black.
Your socks are...
My socks! Well,
by the way, we have to talk about that.
I like my socks.
They are out of style.
Aren't they?
isn't white in certain, particularly certain Asian societies, actually
represents death.
Yes. And red represents prosperity, so which is why Chinese restaurants are always red and never white.
That's right. Or in the Indian, traditional Indian garb, you wear red to get married in.
Right.
Instead of white and black, I think it'd be more helpful or less racist if we said like light and darkness, because sort of light and absence of light, which is just sort of like the sun versus darkness.
Yeah, just like with Tonglen.
Pema was very, she changed the language with that, you know. She really did change that. And instead of black and white, like different words. So I think one thing we do have to try to keep an open mind to whatever the language is, and then speak up if it's disturbing, or, you know, we can talk about these things.
Just acknowledge it.
Yeah, acknowledge it.
Never apologize, just acknowledge it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,